Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. And our guest today is Lori Scheck, the author of Cyborg Fever. She's also the author of The Monster's Notes, which is a reimagining of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And that book was chosen by Entertainment Weekly as one of the 10 best fictions of the year and longlisted for the Dublin Impact International Fiction Prize. She's also the author of the novel Island of the Mad and 5 books of poems, including The Willow Grove, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. She has received many awards, and her work has appeared widely in publications such as The New Yorker and The Paris Review. She lives in New York City, but I understand she's calling us today from Redwood City, California. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Lori.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
So what are you doing in Redwood City?
Well, my boyfriend lives here. So I live during the year in New York, and I teach at the New School in the Graduate Creative Writing Program. But then when school is out, I come here, and it seems to be a lucky time to be here because New York was like 100 degrees, and then there was this terrible flooding in the city. So I'm lucky.
Wow. Yeah. And it's beautiful. So you're in Northern California, right? So
yeah. Near San Francisco, and there are, you know, lemon trees and orange trees. For me, a New Yorker, this is just amazing to walk down the street and see lemon trees, orange trees, fig trees, blue sky.
Wow. Yeah. So Cyborg Fever is, it's kind of not a common type of book. So how would you describe it?
Well, I started out as a poet. I was a poet for many, many years of my writing life. It never occurred to me that I would write a novel. And when I was writing my 5th book of poems, I had a fellowship to the Radcliffe Institute at Harvard to write that book. At the same time, my husband had fallen very, very ill. And he moved in such a way that it reminded me of the monster in Frankenstein. I had never read Frankenstein. I read the book, I was at the Radcliffe Institute, and the monster started to become my imaginary companion. I just started to write things about him and with him. I was living alone in Cambridge at that time because you had to live in Cambridge for the fellowship. I hadn't lived alone for years. And so like when I go to the movies, I think, well, what would the monster like to see since he was my companion? I said, oh, let's go to Blade Runner. You know, he would like that. And so then I'd come home and I'd start, the monster through me started writing notes about things we were seeing. We visited the MIT artificial intelligence robotics lab. He wrote notes about that. And so this was happening. And then I started getting interested in Mary Shelley and her family. And the long and short of it is, a few years later, I had 500 pages. And I didn't call it a novel. It was a prose book. I didn't really know what to call it. It was really itself. I met with my editor at Knopf. I was on the poetry list there at that time. She said to me, she read the book and she said, what is it? And I said, well, it is itself. But it was written. It did kind of tell a story about Mary and the monster, and it did a lot of things. And so I loved writing it because I could do a lot of research. And as a poet, that wasn't something that was really available to me. I loved learning, and I learned a lot. So after I did that, I thought, I really want to write another one. Then I wrote one about Dostoevsky and the Venetian plague, would seem like they wouldn't go together, but in my book they did. What I try to do, I know it's a strange enterprise, but what I try to do with each book is I look for areas of fascination, things that I would really like to learn about, that I would like to investigate. So partly I think of my books as investigations. And at the beginning, I know very little about what I'm going to write about. When I was writing about the Shelleys, I knew nothing. By the end, people thought I was an expert on the Shelleys because I had learned so much. Same with Dostoevsky. And in this book, I thought, well, what would interest me? And I thought, you know, astrophysics, and I know nothing about science. I would like to learn about that. I mean, we live in this universe that we know almost nothing about. And then I got into bioengineering. This character of the cyborg came to me. So really what I do is, as I said, I look for areas of fascination, but then they have to be emotionally grounded in a certain way. Otherwise, I'd be writing nonfiction. So I have characters. And the characters in the book learn about the things that I'm interested in and have certain, you know, travails, issues that they are dealing with. So in this book, I have a main character, a narrator, a little boy who falls into a year-long kind of fever dream. And so in the book, I sort of chronicle the beings that he meets during his fever dream and the kind of things that he learns as he goes along. He learns about astrophysics, bioengineering, as I said, information, computers. So that's, it's a strange book. Yes, it is.
Well, I must admit that I thought you must be a scientist.
No, I knew nothing. And in school, you know, as a little kid, science scared the hell out of me. Science and math, I was terrible. When I took my SATs to get into college, my verbal and my math were like 250 points apart.
Well, that's probably not that uncommon because I think most people are strong in one or the other. There's few that are strong in both.
Yes, but then we become intimidated about the other.
I know. My mother all her life told me she was bad at math. She was not bad at math. She was young, girls weren't supposed to be good at math.
Exactly. And then you start to label yourself in a certain way and limit yourself. And one of the things I found is, I mean, I was very intimidated when I got into the astrophysics. And the thing about being a writer is you don't have to get it right. Because you know, your characters don't have to understand it correctly either. But what I was looking for was the beauty of it. And I found, you know, a lot of the astrophysicists, the scientists, first of all, they were pretty nutty and they were very interesting in terms of their lives. But they said beautiful things. I'll give you an example. Arthur Eddington, who was an astronomer and physicist who lived from 1882 to 1944, he said this: when you disturb the smallest petal of a flower, you trouble the most distant star. That could be a poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there were a lot of things like that.
So, and there's a lot of that in this book. You're talking about these different scientists from 100, 200 years ago and today as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you're quoting them and you're part of this dream is this boy is like, how is he knowing all these things in his dream?
Well, he's an orphan and he was in an orphanage and there was the head of the orphanage, Sister Gudrun, used to read to him all the time. And so one day she read to him a story called Funes the Memorius by Borges. And in that story, the boy Funes has this prodigious memory. He remembers everything. And so when Erwin falls into this fever because he's been rejected by Sister Gudrun, he has this trauma. In his fever, he sees this young man Funes in a white room with a computer. Even though Funes lived in the 1800s, in my book, Erwin sees him in the present, and he can read everything that's on Funes' computer. So that's how he learns. And I wanted a device like that because partly what I think of myself as, in a way, is as a curator. And what I can do is find interesting things and offer them to my reader and share them. Because there are so many wonderful things out there. It's like reality, you really don't have to make anything up. You know, it's just reality is amazing. So I can find these quotes, these facts, put them on Funes' computer. Then my reader, Erwin, the narrator, gets to read them, but so does my reader.
So all of the things that he's reading on this computer are true. are factual.
Yes.
Wow.
And it was funny. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it. I thought it probably was, but it's like there was a lot I didn't know.
Oh, it's amazing. And even things later in the book, he's not necessarily, well, he is seeing things on a computer in a different way. But I was talking to someone recently who was mentioning something in the third part of the book, which is these facts about refugee children in Sweden whose families applied to the migration board to be able to stay in Sweden because their home countries were so dangerous. And when the families get a rejection from the migration board, a lot of the children fall into this sleep and they stay asleep for years. They can't bear to be awake. And it's a syndrome, it's called resignation syndrome. And I was talking to someone recently and they said, oh, you made that up. And I said, no, that's real. Yeah, you know, you don't have to make anything up.
So how did you decide? I mean, it seemed like a lot of these scientists were mad.
Yes.
Is that, well, I mean, these are the people who discovered things like black holes and you know, proof of Einstein's theories. And
yes.
And none of them seem to be to be very normal people. Do you have to be mad to be a genius?
I have no idea. I mean, they weren't necessarily mad. I mean, some were treated in you know, psychiatric hospitals or for rest cures or things like that, but they were eccentric.
Okay, and, that's, you know, a better word.
You know,
yes.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, when you're really thinking about things that defy sort of the normal imagination. You know, a black hole, you can't picture it, or time, what is time or space? They were living in these you know, amazing realms of thought. Boltzmann, who was one of the early physicists, he got terribly made fun of for thinking that atoms existed. This man, another physicist, used to make fun of him whenever he saw him, and he'd say, "Oh, atoms, have you seen one yet?"
You know? So, yeah. Well, who was it that the one who like sort of discovered germ theory and was ostracized because he insisted that surgeons should wash their hands?
Exactly. So, you know, things can seem very strange at the beginning. It happens in visual art too. Look at Picasso, or Gertrude Stein in writing, but look at Picasso when he started making his cubist forms. And people were saying, that's weird, you know, that's ugly. And Picasso would say, I can't wait around for you to see that it's beautiful. I have my work to do. So, and Gertrude Stein said the same thing. I can't wait. I'm going to do my work. Years from now, you'll see it's beautiful. And that's what happened.
So with A Monster's Notes, you did write something that was unusual and yes. And unique, and yet it got great acclaim.
Yes, that astonished me.
That's what I was going to ask.
I'm telling you, I had no idea. I had been a poet my whole life. And, you know, John Ashbery said about publishing a book of poems, it's like dropping a rose petal down a well. So I wrote, you know, A Monster's Notes, and they decided to publish it in fiction, as fiction. It isn't prose. It was a long book. And I expected nothing of it. There were no, you know, there was no author's tour or this or that, nothing. And so I was at my computer on the night of publication, like, you know, I would be any other night, and these things start popping up. Washington Post, full page review, San Francisco Chronicle. I go, what's going on? And then the head of publicity at Knopf called me up the next day and he said, we did nothing for your book. I don't know why this is happening. We had this full page review in Entertainment Weekly. He said they usually, you know, they
I mean, Entertainment Weekly?
Yeah, they
it's
loved
like
it.
Pop fiction, right?
Yeah.
Normally,
well, normally they do like, you know, Hollywood stars autobiographies.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So, and it was really wild. And what I think happened was, I didn't realize that there was such an interest in Frankenstein. I got into Frankenstein for my own idiosyncratic reasons. My husband was very ill. His illness reminded me of the monster, you know, various things. Then I did my own investigations. I caught on. I got contacted by DreamWorks, the movie company, to see about making a movie of my book. I mean, there's no way you could make a movie of that book. It was very philosophical, and you know, it was brainy. It was really brainy. I loved writing that book. And when I wrote it, I thought, I didn't even know that anyone would publish it. But I thought to myself, you know, I've been writing these poems. I really love writing the poems, but there's something else I want to do. And I would picture myself as like a very old woman in a rocking chair, looking back on my life, thinking, if I hadn't tried something different, would I regret it? And I thought, absolutely, I would regret it. So I just went on this adventure of writing this book, and I thought it was going to stay in a drawer. I didn't think anyone would be interested in it, but it was one of the great loves of my life. So it ended up being a very wonderful experience.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Laurie Scheck, author of Cyborg Fever. Let's review or go back to this comment you made about being a curator. Why is that? Do you think that's always been the case that a writer needs to be a curator, or is this something that is increasingly important in this day and age?
I don't think it's been the case at all. And I don't necessarily think it's important. I think it's what I do. I'm very interested in how I can incorporate nonfiction into fiction, because I am fascinated with nonfiction. And I think it teaches us a lot about the world, about reality. It's very beautiful, fascinating, frightening in its own way. But there are many different ways to make a novel. I think there's a misunderstanding, though, where most people think, oh, a novel, it's a story. That's one way to make a fiction. But there are various ways. I just found my own way. But, you know, no, most people don't do it that way. But it's the way I can do it. It's my way.
It's your way.
Yeah.
So what are some of the... Like you did share a couple of things that you found about astrophysics and these people and put in the book, but are there some other sort of facts, favorite facts that you learned?
Well, there are so many.
And I know.
I mean, my book is full of them. That's the thing. It's just full of them. And I don't have them right in front of me at the moment, but there are so many interesting little details, not even just about astrophysics. Like, I didn't know, like, the first the first human to walk in space was Alexei Leonov, the Russian cosmonaut. I had no idea that he had a little cyanide pill in his pocket just in case things didn't work out, because no one had ever walked in space before. They'd never been out of the capsule. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And in fact, he almost didn't get back in the capsule because his spacesuit started filling with, I don't know if you call it air or whatever it was. And he had to somehow diffuse it so that he could get back through the little door of his space capsule.
Like he blew up.
Yeah, he blew up. Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting is with both him and Edward White, who was the first American to walk in space, neither of them wanted to go back in the capsule. Edward White said, "This is the saddest day of my life, saddest moment of my life," when his co-pilot pulled him back in. So there was something just very magical and mystical about being out there. On another note, I didn't know that Alan Shepard had played golf on the moon. So there are a lot of little factoids that you learned. And I learned a lot at one point about the first dog who was sent into space, Laika. I found her very interesting. I was interested in the book partly in experimental subjects and in humans and animals who are subjected to medical and biomedical experimentation. And Laika was one of those. So there are just many, many things to learn that are really, you know, they're just fascinating.
One of the things that I found interesting was this, there's this, these types of planets that you can't see.
Exoplanets.
So tell us a little bit about them.
Well, the exoplanets, there are tons, so there are many, many more planets than we know of. And they have really interesting characteristics that, once again, you would think, oh, this is science fiction, but it's real. There's one planet that its surface is like cotton candy. That's the surface. There's another planet that literally rains diamonds.
Really? You know, that's real?
Yeah.
That's real.
It's real.
How do we know?
Well, there's been scientific exploration. There are machines that can calibrate certain things, about these planets. We have more and more access to, well, with the Hubble telescope, with various things, we have more and more access to what's really out there. I mean, we still know so little, so little.
Yeah, and then I think you wrote in there that these exoplanets are, there's probably far, far more of them than the planets that we can see.
Yes. Yes. And even the amount of stars, you know, when you see, you know, one little star, there are ways of which if you could look really closer, that little pinpoint would turn into millions.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the other thing is that the scientists do think that this has to do with entropy, that everything in the universe is moving away from everything else. So if humans are still on planet Earth, which is a little doubtful, billions of years from now, but we won't see, but reality
yes.
will see, there will be no stars visible in the night sky. The night sky will look completely black because all the stars will have moved too far away for anyone on Earth to see them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then there was another thing, another little fact in there about, was it antimatter or something that we're creating or capturing mm-hmm. or something, but the amount that has been captured is like minuscule.
Yeah, you couldn't even light a light bulb.
And yet we've spent probably millions or billions of dollars to do
that. Billions. Billions. Well, you know, there's this whole, you know, CERN in Switzerland, right, where they're doing all these experiments. Oh, the machines, the machinery, the technology is extraordinary. But yeah, we're still at the beginning of just even capturing a teeny little piece of antimatter.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
So this book, Cyborg Fever, you had some inspiration from a film, I believe, and also from that wonderful story, the Borges story that you talked about. How did those inspire this?
So My books are kind of interactive. As I said, like with Monster's Notes, I interacted with Frankenstein and other writings by Mary Shelley. I also managed to put a great Chinese classic novel in the middle of it, and which was fun and interesting. And then in Island of the Mad, I interacted with Dostoevsky's amazingly great book, I think, The Idiot. And this one, the inspiration was, originally I saw a film, a Fassbinder film called In a Year of 13 Moons. And I thought I was going to write much more about it. It's a very bleak, painful, but wonderful film. And I lifted the character of Erwin, the narrator, and Sister Gudrun, the head of the orphanage, from that. but there's barely a seed of that film left. And then the Borges story I had loved for years about Funes the Memorius, this young man who, he has an accident, he falls from a horse, he can't move his legs anymore, he's partially paralyzed, but he finds that his mind is different. He can anything he reads, he remembers all of it. And so I thought, given that we live in this information age, it would be interesting to deal with a character like Funes, who has all this information in his head in a different way than we have now. And partly what I did is in the book is, and I didn't consciously set out to do this, but it ended up being an exploration of this in part, which was I looked at two different kinds of information. The kind of information we've been talking about, the facts, these amazing facts about astrophysics and other things that really have attached to them a sense of awe and wonder, and really wonderful to think about. There's that kind of information. Then there's the other kind of information that we get on our phones all the time, on our computers, this glut, where there's just so much coming in. And that's when I created a character, this character of the cyborg, who's been part of a biomedical experiment, and by the end of the book, his brain has been operated on and meddled with in such ways that, against his will, he turns into this unfeeling information machine. He just starts spewing information, fact after fact after meaningless fact.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Laurie Scheck, author of Cyborg Fever. How did you come or decide how to organize this book? So, and maybe you did, you've kind of referred to the different parts of the book. So, you know, what are they, and what was the thought process in getting to that?
Well, I learned about this structure when I was writing A Monster's Notes, because honestly, when I was writing A Monster's Notes, I had no idea what I was doing. And when I teach fiction writing classes at the New School, I teach poetry writing and fiction writing in seminars. A few years ago, when I went in to teach my first fiction writing class, because mostly I'd been teaching poetry, I said to my students, this is the first fiction writing class I've ever been in. I never took one. So I was making up my own way that would work for me. And as you pointed out, it doesn't look like a regular traditional novel. What I've done is I tend to divide the books into several parts. So this one, the first part is the narrator looking at Funes' screen and learning a lot of facts about astrophysics. The first part in this book is divided into two. In the second part, Sister Gudrun, head of the orphanage, who has rejected him and given him absolutely no reason for why she did it. He has visitations from her in which she starts to talk to him about herself, about his background, their story, and he finds that rather traumatic. And then she disappears. She just disappears. And he finds himself sort of alone and desolate, and then this cyborg comes to him and says, I've been watching you, and I feel badly for you, and they kind of become friends. Erwin, the narrator, he's in this fever dream. He can't talk, but he listens to the cyborg, and the cyborg really has a lot of affection for him, and Erwin has for the cyborg as well. The cyborg tells the story of what happened to him in the lab when he was an experimental subject. Then he too disappears. Erwin finds himself alone again. But then in the third section, he starts getting messages from the cyborg, who he thought had died. And that's when he witnesses that the cyborg has been sort of taken over by this biomedical experiment, and this lovely feeling person of a cyborg is turning into an unfeeling information machine. And that's the book.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with the concepts of artificial intelligence.
Yes.
And bioengineering.
Yes.
And the morality of those.
Yes, yes. And I it might be worth saying that the bioengineering, once again, I wasn't particularly conscious of it when I started the book, but I was at the very end. And when you talk about the morality of bioengineering, there's an autobiographical aspect to this, which in my books, I always keep the autobiographical hidden. I don't write directly about myself, but I am what is known as a DES daughter. Between the 1940s and the 1970s, several million women were given a synthetic estrogen that was supposedly make it so that they wouldn't miscarry their unborn children. This synthetic estrogen, it was approved by the FDA when the FDA knew it was harmful. So what it did was it harmed the unborn children. I was one of those. My mother was given that. And so I have had lifelong difficulties from that synthetic, from that. It really was like a biomedical experiment in a way. I mean, it was to the benefit of pharmaceutical companies. It only harmed the people that it was given to. I got off easy in a way, because what happened was, when a number of the little girls who were DES babies started to get to the age of puberty or a little later, they started to die. And yeah, they got a very rare cancer. I am infertile from it, but I didn't have that. And so I'm interested in the ethics involved in things like that, the decisions that are made, and what it feels like to be, you know, a subject of an experiment. Yeah.
So is the cyborg, was a human, completely human to begin with?
Yes.
And then experimented on and became turned into a machine, basically?
Yeah, well, he's a sort of hybrid of human and machine, which is what cyborgs are. He has, in my book, he has no memory of his past. He doesn't know what his life was before he was in the lab. But they've done various, you know, experiments on him. And in this book, the experiment is they're trying to make a soldier who has no empathy, because they think that would make a very effective soldier. And in fact, once again, this sounds like fiction, but I looked up the DARPA website, which is the US Defense Department research arm. And they're doing all sorts of experiments like this. They're doing things like if a soldier gets wounded, how can we delay his pain for 3 months so that he can keep fighting? You can go to the website and you can find these things. They're all, and how can we do, they are doing a lot with a mind control as well. And it's interesting. It's available to the public. You can go to the DARPA website and look it up. Most people don't think to do this or don't want to, but it's out there and it's really worth thinking about.
You have like a paper from DARPA in here. A preliminary report. Is that a real report?
Yes, it is.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, and it was striking to me where the former director of DARPA is saying, like, well, mind control is really no different from having a cochlear implant, you know, when you can't hear. It's just, you know, we're just refining humans. And I thought, whoa, that's a quote worth putting in there, because who would think somebody actually says that? But he did.
Wow. Yes, soldiers having no physical, physiological, or cognitive limitation will be key to operational dominance and survival.
Yes, that's a direct quote. That's what I've been saying. You don't have to make this stuff up.
Whoa. Okay. So this is not a science fiction book.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, often in science fiction, science fiction often points towards reality, right? It's very good at diagnosing what's really going on. But no, mine is not science fiction in that way. Yeah.
Well, Lori, why don't you read a little bit from Cyborg Fever?
Okay. So as I mentioned, the book is in, well, maybe I didn't mention, the book isn't sort of a continuous narrative. It's in little parts. So I'll read some parts.
Okay.
So this is the cyborg speaking. He says, "The scientists at the lab knew more about my history than I knew myself. They knew how I came to be as I am, who I was, what steps were taken, and they kept getting more information from the sensors attached to my head, the black box, the many tests they gave me. The Helsinki Declaration insists the well-being of the individual research subject must take precedence over all other interests. Research must promote respect for all human subjects and protect the subject's dignity, integrity, privacy, and right to self-determination. In Article 22, it states all participation must be voluntary, but I knew from my own life that isn't true." Then he says, he had been trying to find out what the experiment that he was in was really about, because no one would tell him. So in this passage, he's talking about going into an office and looking through folders and things like that, trying to find some things out. "Even though I knew I shouldn't, a few times I still slipped into Dehane's old office. One night I came across a note in red ink, quote, 'In the near future, mind reading will be as easy and available as reading from a page,' unquote. On the note's other side, also in red ink, was a quote from Proust, quote, 'A person is a shadow that can never be penetrated, and of which there can be no such thing as direct knowledge,' M. Proust," unquote. The handwriting was Dehane's. I wondered if he was arguing with himself. Then the cyborg, what he does is he's been sent to a white room where all he has to do during the day is look up things on a computer. And so he says, "And so the days in the white room went on. Often I spent hours hunting down keywords, biological, mind, loneliness, etc. Quote, "The line between the biological and technological world is exceedingly thin and always unstable," unquote. That felt like a description of myself. Quote, "Despite technologies that make us more connected, Western industrialized societies are experiencing an epidemic of loneliness and social isolation," unquote. Now, if you want me to read more, I could read a little about Laika the dog, but I could also stop.
Yeah, let's hear that.
Okay. So the cyborg, for reasons I won't get into or who's telling him, he learns the story of Laika. The story was about a dog named Laika. I closed my eyes in the darkness, felt it wash over me. I learned she was one of a group of Moscow street dogs rounded up for a secret program to send the first canine into space. Data was needed on the effects of space travel on a complex biological organism. Street dogs were chosen because they were survivors of the hardships of hunger and bad weather. They'd already proved their toughness, and all the chosen dogs were female, quote, "more naturally compliant than males," unquote. Their small stature also fit the narrow cabin. At the intake center, they described her as quiet and charming. She was quickly evaluated for outstanding levels of passivity and obedience and passed with flying colors. Only one of the 10 canine trainees would be sent into space. If Laika was chosen for the mission, she would become the first living being to orbit Earth alone. That night, then the cyborg is talking, "that night I couldn't sleep. I thought to myself, I am an experimental subject listening to an experimental subject tell me the life story of an experimental subject. And I started to realize that being an experimental subject is like being in someone else's dream, but it's a dream you can't wake up from because you are the dream." And then it says, Laika's training was extremely rigorous and relentless. In order to get her used to confinement, she was locked inside progressively smaller, pressurized capsules. Her first confinement lasted a few hours, her final confinement for 20 days. As her isolation grew more prolonged, she learned not to cry. Other parts of her training included a centrifuge that mimicked the violent acceleration and noises of space flight. Inside it, her heart rate soared, her blood pressure spiked, her respiration quickened. In yet another device, she was secured to a mechanical arm and spun in circles. In zero gravity, regular dog food flies out of its bowl, so technicians developed a gelatinous mix of agar, water, dried meat, and beef fat, which Laika repeatedly refused. But with her regular food withheld from her, she learned to eat it. On a space flight, this mixture would provide the only source of water. And then in the end, there's a choice being made between the three finalist dogs. And Laika is one of them. So is Mooka and Albina. So what happens is it turned out that though the Soviets could send the dog into space, they had no way of bringing it back. So whatever dog was sent into space was going to die. So in this passage, I talk about the other two dogs and Laika. Mooka was considered too homely to represent the state. Her hind legs were too short, her body disproportionate. She was picked as the control. Her real-time biological data on Earth would be compared to the real-time data sent back from the canine in space. Albina was beautiful, with silky white hair and perfect proportions, and had already served on several minor missions. The trainers knew and loved her best. Albina was everyone's darling. It was exceedingly painful to think of sending her to her death. So Albina was named backup. Laika was chosen so Albina could live. Yeah. And that's another part of the story that a lot of people don't know. Yeah, and then Laika, you know, she was this brave, I really became so fond of her. She was this brave little dog. She was really heroic. She was in her little space suit, you know, all alone in this capsule, and she didn't know what was going on. And then she died. She died very quickly because the Soviets and the Americans were in a rush to, you know, who could do this first. And so they were both cutting corners. And what happened in Sputnik 2 is the heating, the temperature control malfunctioned, and the capsule, Laika's capsule, got very, very hot within hours after takeoff, and she died of heat stroke.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, Lori, when you decided to write this book, where did you start?
I started taking notes about astrophysics and trying to find some way in that like a non-science person like me could get into. So, you know, I read a biography of Tesla. I started reading about, you know, the lives, but also just writing down quotes, things that were said, watching videos. There's some good videos online, you know, by astrophysicists who really can explain things quite well. And so I just was sort of accumulating information. And at the same time, I was trying to feel my characters. So whereas in Monster's Notes, when I started it, I really went from page one to page 520, whatever it was, really chronologically. And this one wasn't like that. I was just really trying to feel and experience the subject matter, the characters I felt I was living with. And I shifted things around for a while. And then I thought, well, I'm going to present the facts at the beginning because they're so interesting. And then sort of take it from there.
Mm. When you sat down to write, then did you like write the whole first section and then go on to the second? Or did you move things around later?
I did go chronologically, basically. Like, I didn't even know there was going to be a cyborg in the book until I was like 100 pages in. And it really was like a visitation. This cyborg came to me. He started talking. And I thought, wow, I really like him. And there are different ways to write books when I was at the Komen Center for Scholars and Writers, where I had a fellowship 1 year at the New York Public Library, it was interesting because there were 12 of us around a central area. We all had offices, and there were different kinds of writers and scholars there, not necessarily fiction writers, historians. I could see the different ways that people wrote books, and some people would set up like a timeline on their wall or a structure of this is what this book is going to be, and I just have to work my way through it. For me, a book is more of an adventure. You know, Robert Frost said, no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. And I feel that. And that's one reason I find writing my books exciting, but also scary, because honestly, I don't know what's going on. And, I remember when I was first writing a Monster's Notes, and I had finished the first 150 pages, I came down to New York to see my husband and daughter, and I said to them, be ready for me to be in a really bad mood, because I just wrote 150 pages. I have no idea what's coming next.
Oh, wow.
No idea. Yeah, and I didn't want to throw out those pages, but I didn't know what was going to come.
So how do you get through that?
Well, you have to be very determined, and, you know, you can get very upset. And then, finally, something like you just keep thinking. And in that case, there was a character in Frankenstein, because I was using the characters in Frankenstein, Clerval. He was a translator. He had gone east, and he had been killed by the monster. He was Victor Frankenstein's friend. So I thought, well, in my book, I'm going to keep Clerval alive, and I'm going to send him to China. In Mary Shelley's book, he didn't translate from the Chinese, but my husband was very involved with China. And I had ways of knowing about it. And I thought, well, I'll have Clerval translate this great Chinese novel, Dream of the Red Chamber. I had to read it first. It was like over 1,000 pages. And it was an amazing novel. It was, so that became a great adventure too.
Wow.
But, you know, and the only reason, and that was like, I was flying by the seat of my pants, because I only chose The Dream of the Red Chamber because I liked the title. I had no idea what was going to be in it. And then it turned out to be extremely relevant.
Wow.
So, you know, you don't know. You try. All you can do is try.
So do you, like, when you don't know what's going to happen, do you just keep writing, or do you stop and do this thinking and like reading something else and before you go back to the writing?
Yeah, I look around at different materials, and
okay,
I think, you know, what direction can I possibly go in? And I try out different things. You know, it's Samuel Beckett's thing, fail again, fail better. I think in order to succeed as a writer, you have to be willing to fail a lot, because you have to be willing to experiment, right? So, I mean, I tell this to my students all the time. If you want to succeed, fail. You know, try things. That's really how it works. And so, that's what I do.
So do you have any failed novels sitting in a drawer?
I don't, because I think I'm such a slow writer, and I came to novels only like, 15 years ago. I've now written 3. I'm slow. I have scraps of things around. Actually, last night I was just looking at some. I have this form called an essay poem, which I write, and I have a bunch of those that I think I will go back to those. As you know, most writers have things,
mm-hmm.
But the novels, no, they're so hard to do.
So how do you know when a novel is finished? Because there's not a, you know, kind of a, maybe plot isn't that big a factor here. So you know, maybe the ending could continue. How do you decide when you've reached the end?
Well, I guess you sort of sense it. I feel like when I'm living with my characters, and sometimes their story, their quest or their struggle has come to an end. And then, you know, in certain cases, I have to kill off the character and I feel terrible because I love them. I feel such tenderness towards them, but I know what they've had to say or what they've had to go through is over. And that's that. And then with the Monster's Notes, in the third part of that book, the monster is sort of going through Mary Shelley's biography, her life. She's talking and he's sort of watching over her and then she dies. And now, that's wow. really the end of the book. I've gone through her life and the monster is still in the Monster's Notes. The monster can't die. It's the 21st century. He's living in the East Village in New York. But he will marry. And he's the survivor and all the Shelleys have died. Yeah.
Now, do you have anyone read as you're going? Do you have any readers that you get feedback from, or do you wait till you're finished?
I have one reader. So my husband for many years was a senior editor at Pantheon Books at Random House. And then he went on to do some other things, and he published nonfiction. He was the editor of Noam Chomsky, William Fulbright. He did those kind of books. But he's an excellent reader. And what would happen is when I started writing the novels, I would write a few pages each day. I would email them to him. And then at dinner, we would talk. And so my characters became like part of our little family. It was really, we both loved it. And then when I finished a book, we'd both be sad because it's like, oh, the monster isn't here anymore. You know, Mary's not here. And, you know, so I was very lucky to have him. And he's very devoted. So like when I was first learning to write novels, and of course, as I said, I don't write traditional novels, but still I had to teach myself a lot of things. He would do things like, he was a very good researcher. And I remember coming home one day and he had ordered like 12 volumes of like all the plots in Western literature. And he was reading them. He was just sitting there reading them. And so that, you know, that was like a wonderful resource for me. He was great that way.
Oh. And now?
Well, we still do talk. He got very ill, so it's a little harder for him, but I still hear him in my head all the time. You know, he taught me so much, and I've taught myself a lot too. I was never one of those people who like wanted to be part of a writing group or anything like that. I seem to need a certain amount of privacy, safety, I guess, in order to really write. So I let my husband in, but that was about it. He's the only one who sees what I write until it's all done.
Okay. Then when it goes to an editor, mm-hmm. what's that process like for you? Is there a lot of back and forth?
No. they pretty much leave me alone.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Just, I mean, I handed something that I feel, I mean, with the Monster's Notes, the editor suggested I write a little preface. But basically, I you know, when it's done, I hand it in. And I remember at Knopf, the editors, they have, you know, a copy editor who goes through it. And I remember she said to the copy editor, just do a very light copy editing. So the kind of copy editing they do there is if on page 17 you say dreamed and on page 75 you say dreamt, you know, the copy editor points it out, which is very useful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But basically, I write the book and I hand it in.
Now, do you do your own? I mean, obviously, you're doing some editing and revision. Do you do it as you go, or do you write a first draft and then go back and work through the whole thing again?
I do both.
You do both. I think that's common, actually.
Very, and it makes sense. You know, if you write, like, let's say I write a page, I will print that out. I'll make a hard copy. I will write all over it. And I'll revise, depending on the page, I could revise that page, I don't know, 10, 15 times. Partly what happens is I really care about sentences. I want the sentence to be the best sentence it could be. And sometimes the way you do that is you take the end of the sentence and you move it to the beginning. And then the rhythm is better and the sound is better, things like that. And I really enjoy that. But I was like a little nerd in school who liked, you know, diagramming sentences. All day. My class hated it. I thought that was the most fun thing.
That was like, so, I loved story problems in math where everybody else hated them.
Yeah. You know, it's the nerd in you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. That really just enjoys it. And, you know, for a writer, it's lucky if you, who are writers? Partly writers are people who like to move words around. You know, that's partly what writers do. And that is, you know, a lot of revision is that. And also, by the time you finish a book, you know it a lot better than you did at the beginning. So there are things you can go back to at the beginning and refine. You know your characters better, right? You've gotten to know your character, things like that.
And with computers, it's so easy to make changes. I mean, I'm old enough that we didn't have computers when I was, you know, writing as a young person, and making edits was laborious.
Oh my God, remember Whiteout?
Yes, I certainly do. And how great it was when we got typewriters that you could correct on the typewriter without Whiteout. They had a white part of the ribbon.
Yes, exactly. yes. I mean, it's so easy now, you know, cut and paste and all that kind of, it's amazing.
It certainly is. Well, yeah. Lori, I want to thank you so much for being with us today to talk about Cyborg Fever, which is it's a fascinating book, and it's obvious that it's written by a poet, even though I also thought it was written by a scientist. So
well, thank you so much. This has been really a very pleasurable conversation. Thank you.
And we always close with a quote, and so, you know, talk about astrophysics, Neil deGrasse Tyson has some wonderful quotes. And I chose, "We are stardust brought to life, then empowered by the universe to figure itself out, and we have only just begun."
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And I think that fits your book pretty well.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thanks a lot.